Documentation is the key, and you know, administration. So, making sure that progress meetings are recorded and delivered. So it's having that paperwork in place is fantastic, because the minute you are reliant on verbal exchanges, then the risk levels significantly increase because it's difficult to evidence.
Welcome everybody to another episode of the Build Smart Blueprint. I am excited today to have on our podcast Alan Pugh. So Alan is the head of construction and engineering at Hill-Dixon. So Hill-Dixon, you may or may not have heard of them, but if you have had legal issues, you probably have heard of them. Hill-Dixon are an international law firm, very well known, particularly in the construction and engineering sector, for dealing with a number of high profile cases, but also a lot of technical cases. And I'm excited to have Alan on board today because Alan's got a lot of experience in construction law. And as we all probably know, running a company, there's lots of interface with contracts, negotiations, dealing with all types of kind of matters of compliance. So I'm really excited to kind of get into this with Alan. Welcome to the podcast, Alan. How are you?
Thanks, JP. I'm obviously delighted to be here, and obviously we've worked together over a number of years, really. So we know how each other operates, and I've got an insight into the SME world as well. So yeah, it's great to be here, and hopefully I can add some value.
It was interesting how I found you guys when we started working together, because it was actually I was looking at a competitor of mine that had gone through some litigation, and I kind of worked out okay, who actually dealt with that particular matter, and that's how I came across you guys. And I think it can be kind of tough to sometimes find a company that in law that suits small to medium sized construction companies, because you know it can get expensive, as we were talking earlier, when you're racking up fees, and you want to make sure that the person that you're speaking to understands your perspective, and that's exactly why I got you on this podcast. One thing actually that came to mind, and I realized that it's been a few years since I've actually spoken to you on video yourself. You know, usually I'm dealing with one of your team, and actually since that time is when AI has started to come into play. You know, I think we used to be chatting pre ChatGPT, and I was really curious just to understand how things have changed for you guys in your practice, in terms of you know, your use of ChatGPT, but also your clients as well. And has that changed the landscape for you at all?
I think it probably has for clients more than it has for us at the moment. And in fact, we had an internal conversation about ChatGPT only last week, because the number of people using it is significantly increasing. And certainly the policy within Hill-Dixon is if you're going to use it, you need to get approval, because, I mean, my knowledge of ChatGPT is fairly limited, but my understanding is it takes information from everywhere and it doesn't differentiate between good and bad information. So I've had examples recently where clients have come in and said, I'd like to issue an injunction, and I've had one prepared already. And here it is from ChatGPT. And you look at it and think, say, I can't issue that. I'm sorry. It's just not in an acceptable format. On the flip side, we've had situations where a client's had an expert report done. So there may be a defect in a building, maybe a ground defect-related defect. They've got a structural engineer's report. The structural engineers use lots of technical jargon. They've put that report into ChatGPT, and it summarised the report in layman's terms. And actually, you read that summary and say, actually, yeah, that's all right. I wouldn't have done anything different to that. Yeah. So I think it's horses for courses. When it comes to the use of AGI, I think we're still really early days. And certainly, I mean, I'm a bit of a traditional lawyer, and I like drafting. You know, I like doing things myself. I don't need an AI computer to do it for me. So my preference, certainly, at the moment is to do it.
Have you found it's kind of affected your business in terms of, because I'll be honest, actually, I have been guilty of it, even with your practice. I can answer the question that, you know, some of the volume of stuff I've given you guys has reduced, because I'm like, okay, let me just play this out with a free kind of ChatGPT to get some initial advice before starting to kind of rack up some fees to get some proper advice, because often, and maybe it's to my kind of detriment, it's kind of like, well, ChatGPT is already telling me this is a no-go, like there's no way, or there's it's not worth me pursuing whatever I'm thinking of pursuing. But have you found that kind of similarly, or, you know, a change in...
I mean, that's very open of you. Yeah, most clients probably don't tell us that they're using it. but I'm sure they are in the background. And again, my understanding is it depends what you ask. How you phrase the question will dictate the answer you get. And I think that is absolutely critical. So I think, you know, my advice to anybody thinking of using it is go into it with your eyes wide open and perhaps even get a better understanding of the outputs from ChatGPT before actually putting the question in. Because if you're just using it freely and you have no real knowledge, then that's very dangerous. But I think if you've got that understanding of the information that's being churned out, then it certainly puts you in a better position.
Yeah, I haven't kept up with things that much lately, but the ChatGPT in the early versions, it used to do this thing called hallucinating, which is when there's a gap in its knowledge, rather than telling you there's a gap, it would make things up. And you often had to specifically say, do not hallucinate, just base this on facts. And a lot of people didn't really know that. And I used to, when I was testing out, I used to ask it things about construction that I knew 100%. And I would ask it to see, and even when I was telling it not to hallucinate, it was still kind of hallucinating, or it was, you know, using things from different countries and stuff like that, which obviously come into play. So, I'm interested to see how that kind of develops as well.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think you can't beat, you know, it's all very well asking chat, but I would also then recommend speaking to somebody with the relevant expertise. Yeah. And as you said, you could maybe reduce your cost exposure by saying, look, this is what I know already. Can you either confirm or an advance, you know, add value to this? And if so, how much would that cost?
Yeah. I've also actually used it, and again, being open with your team, when they've, because sometimes it can be quite overwhelming when lawyers come back to you with like stuff. And they use terms. It's the same when we as construction professionals use terms to our clients, you know, all these abbreviations, assuming they know what it means and you don't, to actually plug in the email that, let's say, my lawyer sent me and say, okay, this is what I think. I wasn't really sure what they're saying here. Can you just explain it to me?
Yeah.
And then that would put it in. But also, I recognized... that I'm not getting necessarily billed hourly. Basically, my lack of clarity in my response back to my lawyer would cause inefficiency on their part, which ultimately would mean they'd be billing more time for me because I'm not clear on what I'm trying to say. So I often use it, and this is not just for legal things, but other things, to put my thoughts in a clear manner to allow the professional to work more efficiently on the other end, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, and I think that's a very good use of the tool, definitely. Yeah, if you can, the more you can narrow the issues for the advice that you seek, then the quicker the lawyer can turn it around and the more precise the lawyer can be as well, which can only be to your benefit.
Yeah. I earlier on the call before we started recording, you just talked about this... this idea or this misconception, I think, of lawyers always just being expensive and it's being a cost, especially for small, medium-sized construction firms where there isn't necessarily a budget for litigation and lawyers' fees. Based on your experience, what are there any kind of particular things that, like good practices that companies can do when things are going well, to make it easier if things don't go well, because some things are unplanned where they don't go well, to kind of help them manage issues? Is there stuff that you think they could be doing better?
Well, definitely. I think, and only this week I had a situation arise where, because of the new Building Safety Act that's came into play, and particularly the new duty holder regs, which came in last year, they are going to have a major impact on the industry. And the reason why is because they've got these competency requirements. So any contractor carrying out works in the UK has to be competent in order to do those works. And that sounds straightforward, doesn't it? And it's everyone says, well, yeah, I'm competent. Why wouldn't I be competent? Yeah. And they probably are competent. But do they have the records to show that? Do they have the audit trail? You know, if they're bidding for a small school extension job or a refurb or even just any sort of residential job where they have to show that it's something they've done before, they've got experience, they've got people who know what they're doing, because it's Building Safety Act is all about building safe buildings. CDM is all about building safely. The Building Safety Act is making sure what's built is safe. So obviously, if you're going to have a safe building, you need a contractor who knows what he's doing and knows if there's a problem, how to fix that problem. So in this recent example that I mentioned, the contract administrator has actually advised the client not to proceed with the contractor, the preferred contractor, even though this contractor has been involved for the last umpteen months on the job, because the principal contractor under building safety only needs to be appointed prior to start of works on site. So there could have been quite a lot of design work, pre-planning work going on before the principal contractor is appointed. If that contractor doesn't have or can't answer the questions around competency and his ability to manage, supervise the project, suddenly he gets kicked off the job. Now, if you know, in order to be prepared for that, if you can put your processes and procedures in place now, so that when you either are tendering for the work or somebody asks the questions, you say, "Yep, got it here. Here's my competencies. This is what I can show you." Then that'll save time, effort, and you know, secure that job.
I mean, often a lot of these things cost money. You know, getting everyone on SMSTS and all these courses and things like that. I'm curious whether you think there's a sort of 80-20 principle that could be applied here of, you know, is there a handful of things that, you know, achieve 80%, not necessarily from a compliance perspective, but I want to kind of take it from a, if a litigation issue came about, if you've got these kind of five things, let's say, in place or processes in place, that you're really well covered, or at least you're really lowering the risk of something slipping through the net.
Documentation is the key. Administration. So making sure that progress meetings are recorded and delivered, you know, the notes of those meetings. You cannot beat having contemporaneous records. Every, you know, if you know, an unfortunate situation arises where there is a dispute, and that could either be a defect in some works, or it could be a non-payment dispute or whatever, the first thing the lawyer is going to ask for, one, is the contract. So make sure that there is a contract in place. And now that contract could be an exchange of emails. You know, it could be, there could be a telephone conversation which is followed up by an email saying, yeah, further to your call, you've instructed us to do this amount, this work for this amount of money during this time frame. You've got the essential elements of a contract in place. So the lawyer will say, where's your contract? And hopefully the contract will say, well, here you go, here it is. And the next thing the lawyer will ask was, so where's the correspondence? Where's the documentation which either supports your position or is detrimental for the other party? You know, so it's having that paperwork in place is fantastic, because the minute you are reliant on verbal exchanges, then the risk levels significantly increase because it's difficult to evidence.
In terms of, because a lot of, especially in the nature of construction sites, a lot of it's verbal communication. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, I think, doesn't make it to electronic communication because things are going mm-hmm. so quickly mm-hmm. and there's a lot mm-hmm. of trust and all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to this kind of idea of finding balance, because also, you know, when you're on site, I've been there before where you want to get going and the other guy mm-hmm. is saying, oh, you need to send me an email, or and it's mm-hmm. going to delay things for a whole 2 days and it's mm-hmm. going to lose program. What kind of things have you seen as a good balance? Because I can't imagine you're saying, oh, everything has to go on paper and be written and signed.
I think everybody has a paper day, or should have. During the week, there must be a period when you have to do your paperwork. And I think at that point, you know, as close to that conversation you can get, you say, okay, you've now asked us to change the windows from this type of window to a different type of window. That's an additional X thousand pounds in cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may have been a site discussion, but really that discussion should be recorded. If it's not recorded via an email, either close to or after the event, in the diary, in the site diary, you know, somebody has to keep a record, and that's just good practice. And the risk is, if you don't keep that record, and, you know, the client, as you've seen, JP, at the end of the job says, I'm not paying you the last 10 grand because I don't want to. It just puts you in a more difficult position, doesn't it, in trying to evidence the value and what you are entitled to, which will then significantly increase your cost.
I've always been curious about WhatsApp and Telegram and things like that, because mm-hmm. a lot of, especially at you know, the clients we work with at mm-hmm. our company now, are you so heavily using WhatsApp?
Yeah.
How much of a legal standing does WhatsApp correspondence have? Is it the same as you know, any other type of email and things like that?
I've seen WhatsApp used as evidence. So if agreements are reached, so obviously you can, you know, you can print off the exchanges, and certainly it's a form of record, isn't it? And if somebody doesn't respond to a message saying, no, that's incorrect, then it could be persuasive as to, well, you know, you didn't respond, the party said X, and had you not agreed, then why didn't you? Oh, well, the other party said, well, I picked up the phone and said, that's not correct. Did you follow us up with anything in writing? No. Well, you know, a judge or, you know, a tribunal then has to decide, well, either I go with what I can see written, or I go with what I'm told as verbal. Well, it's easy to go with the written, isn't it?
Yeah. Going back to this, you know, this theme of fees, you've talked about, you know, the first thing you as a firm would ask for is, can I see your contract?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, can I see the communications? I'm curious mm-hmm. whether, because obviously the worse the communications are, the more kind of spaghetti cluttered they are, I assume mm-hmm. the longer it takes you guys to work out yeah. the position of the client. Mm-hmm. What are some good practices that you like to see to help you as a, mm-hmm. as a firm get to the bottom and add the best mm-hmm. value to your client for the amount you're charging? Like, do you want to see, you know, jobs aligned by project, or do you want to see timestamps? Do you know,
yeah.
what's some good practice there as well that makes your job easier?
A timeline connected to documents. So using technology again these days, you can create links, can't you? So documents generally are scanned in. So you can produce a timeline from, you know, contract inception. Here's the document, just click on the link, you know, through to the point where, if there's a, say, one recently where there's a dispute around handrails, you know, the end user said the rails that you've installed on the stairwell are not building regs compliant. So there's a chronology of events leading up to the installation of those rails. Okay, well, show me that chronology. you know, who said what to whom, what documentation, where are the drawings. So if you, JP, came to me and said, I've got this problem on site, client's refusing to pay me X pounds because he said this isn't in compliance with building regs. If you had a chronology with all the paperwork and you've even gone to an expert, an architect, to say, look, somebody's challenged me. And that doesn't have to be expensive. I mean, this handrail problem was I think the expert's fee was like £500 just to produce a short report, say, yeah, been to site, had a look at it. I've looked at the building regs. It's all compliant. It's fine. Then that significantly reduces. We spend a lot of time shifting through paper, trying to work out what the timeline is, what the arguments are, and, you know, when we've got to that point, we can then actually say, right, well, actually, we think you've got a great case, or we think you've got a rubbish case, and there's no point proceeding with it.
So, in other words, I think it sounds like me as a company owner, if before I am engaging you or even initiating that thing, I can kind of do the legwork before, and rather than saying I've got this issue, actually say, Alan, this is the job, contract was done on this date, this is what happened, now I'm at this stage, I've also had some opinion on this, what can I do? And that it's just saving you guys doing that work, when often us as the client can do it a lot quicker because we know it like off the top of our heads, whereas your owner probably got a mind map somewhere of sticky notes trying to work out and connect the dots, right?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the person involved in the job is by far the best person placed to do it, because obviously, you know, you send it to a lawyer who's had no prior knowledge of the job, never been to site, doesn't know what's been going on, has to start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, and often bits are missing. And you know what it's like when you're doing a puzzle, if you're missing bits, you've got to spend time finding the right piece. So I think that's absolutely right.
If you were to look back at and I think it'd be more applicable to look back at than recent years, because technology has changed so much, but perhaps recent years and cases in the kind of, I wouldn't say small to medium sized companies, but maybe this applies to larger litigation cases. Is there any reoccurring themes of like why your client or maybe the other side may have lost something that could have been much cleaner if they had just done, you know, certain things? Like, is it always coming back to this communication, or is there a more granular thing that keeps, you know, tripping people up? Or is it at contract stage or sales stage where everyone's just saying yes, yes, yes to everything and not really looking at the detail? I'm curious if you would look back at your experience.
Yeah, I think it's probably all of the above. If it was a multi-choice question, you know, ABC, is probably all of the above. I think, you know, yeah, communication is something which you can use as a tool to avoid the dispute. So, you know, if you've got the on-site communication right, then you shouldn't really get involved in disputes. I'd say the majority of our adjudication disputes are around payment. So certainly in the UK, the payment provisions are imposed on everybody by statute. So the Housing Grants Act imposes, so you have to have your due date for payment. You've got to, the employer has to issue his notice of payment due. If the employer then doesn't want to pay the amount that's been notified, he issues his pay less notice, and there must be a final date for payment. And one thing that a lot of listeners may not be aware of is that final payment date must be a fixed date. So with the final payment, it cannot be subject to something else happening. So, for example, you see a lot of contracts where the final payment is subject to receipt of an invoice. That is now unacceptable. That would deem to be contrary to the Housing Grants Act. So what would happen is the payment terms within the Act would imply into that contract. Okay, so you can see how if you don't get it right at the start, so if the parties have a set of terms which aren't compliant with the Housing Act, you end up with a dog's dinner of payment issues, and inevitably potential dispute. We had this instance recently where a contractor actually terminated and it was upheld as well, terminated a contract because the employer was late paying an invoice. So the contractor gave notice when he was late. He was then late paying another invoice. And because of the drafting of the JCT, the contractor then, because it was a repeat of a previous offence, the contractor terminated the contract, which could have all been avoided.
Mm-hmm.
So it's communication and making sure that the contract itself is right. And I appreciate, you know, a lot of the listeners who receive contracts won't want to spend thousands of pounds on getting a contract reviewed.
What was your thought about the types of contracts that one should get into or use? Because I kind of made a decision. I remember I just didn't like JCTs, mm-hmm. and I just thought I'm just gonna. And actually, I came to you guys to say I just mm-hmm. want a custom contract because mm-hmm. I do the same type of work. You know, I have the same types of issues. I'd like that to be done. Have you got kind of a view on whether we should stick to standard contracts like JCTs and the like, or create custom contracts?
I think it very much depends on the nature of the works, the value of the scheme. So JCTs are obviously designed for bigger projects. Yes, you have your minor works JCT, but I think these days that could be anything up to £1 million in works. It's very light touch, that the minor works contract. I think, you know, for what the type of work that you were doing, I think a bespoke contract was spot on, because you wanted something that was easy to read, easy to follow, wasn't going to create any problems. Whereas, yeah, the language in the JCT is something which, you know, you present that to an employer who's never seen or read a contract like that before, they wouldn't have a clue. whereas if you present something that says, we shall do this for you, you shall pay us, you know, this is, we will start on this date and we will, you know, it becomes a lot simpler, doesn't it? So it's very much individually driven. I mean, the vast majority of projects use the JCT, a huge number, you know, percentage-wise in the country. I mean, JCT has been around since 1931, I think. So it's by far the oldest form of contract, and therefore it's been through the mill in relation to the court have scrutinised it. So we pretty much know what the clauses mean and how to operate it.
So from a perspective of if you do get into hot water and you need some legal help, is it a lot easier for you guys to work on a case where it's a JCT, because you can then go back at how similar cases have been treated with similar Absolutely. Clauses or similar situations?
Yeah,
so let's say I'm a subcontractor, I don't know, a groundworks contractor going into a main contract, and there's a JCT involved. Does that limit the amount I can still kind of negotiate certain contract terms and things that can be delivered? Because sometimes I think when you're landed with, okay, this is the contract we're using,
yep.
I think people as subcontractors or even main contractors going in with clients just assume that means there's nothing that they can negotiate. But there is a difference, right? There's not, that doesn't mean that everything that, you know, the client asks for, you have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I work for a number of subcontractors, and a good friend of mine is a subcontractor who's bottom of the food chain. He's a steel fabricator, and he gets presented with these, you know, 500-page contract documents, which, you know, his job's only 50 grand, 30, 50 grand, and yet he's been asked to sign something which is full of indemnities. And he doesn't feel like he's got any opportunity to negotiate that. And a lot of the time he doesn't. But what he can do is he asks me for, you know, just give me a view. What are the bits I need to be overly concerned about, or he goes into the works knowing that if he's got to give a notice or if he has to do something in order to get paid, then that's what he'll do, and focus on the things that he can control rather than worry about all the other stuff, which actually isn't relevant to him. I mean, one bit of advice I can give is understanding your risk. So, capping liability is something which a subcontractor can always do and doesn't really necessarily involve negotiation. So if you're getting paid a very small fee with a very, large potential risk, I've got one at the moment where the fee is just £8,750. And the subcontractors come to me and said, look, I know it's a very small fee, but I just want to know, I want you to cast your eye over and tell me, what should I look out for here? And one of the key things on that one was there was a time of the essence clause, which meant they could just terminate. I said that clearly that's just not relevant, and they've got them to strike that out because it wasn't relevant and it could have serious implications for them. So I think it's having some knowledge of contracts is really useful as an SME if you can look. And there are some key provisions, things like indemnities. Never sign an indemnity. If there's the word indemnity in the contract, then query why it's there. Because the point of an indemnity is it just means whoever's up the food chain, if there's a reason to pursue you because a loss has been incurred, they don't need to prove the loss. They can just simply say, well, there's an indemnity. You've pre-agreed to pay us our loss arising from that breach. And so they don't need to go to court to prove it.
So is there any situation where an indemnity would be justified to have in a contract?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it would be useful to give examples, because then when if someone wants to kick back, I think it's always good to know. Okay, why?
Like in JCT's got a couple of indemnities in the insurance provisions. So if the contractor causes the employer to suffer loss through damage to property, so say it's a third party property that's been damaged, say somebody's car's been damaged, and that the owner of that car sues the employer, but it's your fault, you've caused the damage, something fell on the car, then you're indemnifying, and that's fine because you're insured for that indemnity. So indemnities that are insured events are fine, because providing your insurers are okay with that, and I always advise contractors, look, just check with your broker if they're happy with it. But with a standard JCT, you'd expect it to be acceptable to the insurers, because that's standard wording. So that's, anything like that. Indemnities that you'd say are unacceptable, I think, are indemnities where it's just a blanket indemnity for any breach under a contract. you just say, no, that's not acceptable. Or if you
are... Would you say that a lot of contractors are potentially signing into that without knowing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Main contractors will include fast indemnities in subcontracts to give them that leverage. Now, not to say that a lawyer wouldn't challenge the indemnity anyway, because they'd say, well, that's not an enforceable indemnity, or even with the indemnity, they still have to prove their loss. But just because of the way indemnities have developed over the years.
Yeah. You actually kind of went into a point that I wanted to ask you about, which is this idea of involving a law professional early on and being proactive when managing not just job specific issues, but just managing your business. Because I think a lot of guys don't really think about engaging a law firm until a problem comes, and then it's all kind of last minute. But also I think it's a bit rushed with who you end up appointing, because you kind of got to deal with the issue, and maybe the emotions of the issue are kind of linked to that. So what's your kind of, how can I put it? What do you think is a good way that small, medium-sized construction companies can work in partnership with a law firm, like as an ongoing relationship? How can that dynamic work? And related to that is, what would you look for if you were in our shoes looking for a law practice, someone that can serve you well long-term? Because I think everybody in, most people will want a long-term relationship with a law firm.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in the business now for It's coming on to 30 years next year. And a lot of the people I work with, particularly on contract reviews, are people I've worked with for 20, 25 years. And it's knowing what the client wants by way of that review and input. So you can have, I met a new client last week, and their turnover is, I think he said 30, 40 million turnover. So a decent size business. And I said, look, and they're nervous about the contract terms and the exposure on the jobs that they're undertaking. I said, well, there's two ways of dealing with it. Well, three ways. So you can, the commercial director can read through the terms, get a feel for it, and think, actually, there's some stuff in here I'm not familiar with, and I'd like a lawyer's view on, and then say, look, I've read the terms, I'm okay with all this bit, but these sections I'm not. Can you give us a fixed price for that? That's one way of doing it. Another way is just saying, here's the contract, lawyer, you read through it and just add some comments on it. I don't want anything fancy. Just add some comments, 2 or 3 hours. That's all. And then the third one is, I want bells and whistles. So on a nice glossy table, I want to see the contract clause. I want a commentary on it. And I want your advice on what it should say. So there's different layers depending on risk profile of the job. And I think that understanding comes with working together over a period of time. And the other thing I just wanted to say on this is there's a lot of, you know, there's federations. We used to work with the National Federation of Builders. We're currently working with the FIS, the Fixtures and Interiors Sector Federation. And so certainly for SMEs, they're a really good source because they often have helplines. And we're on a helpline for the FIS where SMEs can come and get a quick view on something they're just not sure about before incurring a additional cost, which I think is a really useful tool. And the other one is insurers. So if there's professional indemnity insurers, if there's a design element to the contract, a lot of insurers offer some sort of free contract service. The only bit of caution I'd add there, though, is insurers would instruct lawyers to do it as part of sort of the overall service. It's insurance-based. So, you know, it's very much looking from an insurer's perspective rather than the sort of the client's perspective. So you're not going to necessarily get that commercial view that you'd have if you have a direct relationship with a lawyer.
Yeah, I did. I used to use the FMB service when I was a member. They had a similar sort of thing, a helpline, which I did find useful for just getting a sense check. It was a little bit... I feel like I grew out of that pretty quickly because it's nice to have the conversation with the same person and to pick up the issue rather than having to re-explain the situation if it's progressed after a week and you want some advice. But definitely, I think a lot of guys are probably paying for that service within some sort of accreditation they've got without even knowing it.
I agree with you. You can't beat having that ability just to pick up the phone and say, Alan, you know, I just want to just check this 5 minutes. That's all I need. It's and if you have a relationship with somebody, then they don't mind doing that.
But in terms of working with a client, do you generally focus more on project issues or project by project? So is it less common to see like reviewing a whole operations of a construction company to look at where they're potentially at risk and stuff? Do you think that there's, you know, we as that kind of small to medium size construction companies could actually be investing more in, you know, getting people to lawyers to review our operations on a whole and proactively find holes that we could be plugging now before issues come? Because I don't think people do that.
No, it's a really interesting point that, and we will get brought in to review suites of documents, very much the legal, but I can't recall us being asked to go beyond that. You know, you'll have your CDM guy who will come in and have a look at all the CDM services and how they operate that. You'll have the, you know, the building safety chap now who could be the same as the CDM doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But everybody's looking at their own little area, aren't they, rather than the sort of more holistic overview of the business and how it...
It was interesting because it was on my to-do list. I never got around to it before I exited. To have you guys do that is just from a litigation point of view, just look at the way everything is done to make sure that small checks could be, you know, just like an audit, basically an internal audit. Because I think especially once you're working with a law firm that understands your business, understands who's who, I don't think it would actually rack that much time up for them, but I think it would be quite useful. Going back to my second part of the question, because I think we haven't addressed it, but I'm keen to, and feel free to plug your firm as well here. But if you were in the shoes of a contractor, how would you choose who to use as a law firm? Like, what questions would you be asking to understand if it's the right fit?
I think there are I could think of five points that, to me, you know, and a lot of it might be personal preference. So you might be somebody who actually likes meeting face to face. You could be old school and you don't want to meet somebody in Teams. You want to have that one to one. So location would be important there, wouldn't it? That you can just have a meeting, have a coffee, whatever it is. So location could be important. Expertise is critical. So you'll have general practitioner lawyers who will know a little bit about everything. Could be family law, could be contract law, could be construction. But they'll probably be scratching the surface. So I think in construction and engineering sector, you need people who that's all they do, because there are a lot of nuances in, particularly around adjudication. If the lawyer doesn't have a background in adjudication, then I'd say that they're not the right person to be advising, because you need to know how the industry works. Cost is clearly an issue, and my advice would be, you know, again, agree a very clear scope and a fixed cost. Lawyers do still, you know, charge on a units basis, but a lot of what we do is fixed. So fixed fee, clear scope. So it gives certainty, doesn't it? Availability as well, and resources. So these days, getting into law is very different to, say, when we started JP a few years ago. So, you know, in my team now, I've got an ex-dental nurse. I've got a chap who was a plasterer. I've got a QS, an engineer. I've got a woman who's come straight from school doing an apprenticeship. You know, these are all people from different backgrounds who've come into law, and they're all at different stages of their legal careers. So you don't want me, Alan Pugh, head of construction at Hill Dix, doing your advice that's going to charge you, you know, hundreds of pounds an hour, whereas actually it's more suitable for somebody who's either on the start of their journey under supervision, or somebody who's newly qualified. So I think it's saying, well, who have you got who's best suited for this particular... If it's a really technical issue, then yeah, you're going to end up paying a little bit more, aren't you, for somebody with a bit more expertise. But the legal profession's opened massively in the last few years. So I think you can horses for courses. You can be a bit more...
I've never actually asked you, but with your department and your firm, like, how is it then split? Because if you've got obviously different... Let's say from a small to medium size company, is, because often I'm talking to different people, which is fine because they're always communicating. But how does that work on the other end? Is it, have you got, everybody's got a client and specialisms, or it's done by turnover with people that kind of chime in and help? That'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, we very much operate as one fluid team across the country. So, I've got people working in Leeds, in Manchester, in London, all for jobs that I'm involved in. It's really to do with availability. There will be elements where it's particular expertise. So I know, you know, Matt in London is particularly good at a certain aspect. You know, you give me a call and said, look, I've got this problem. I said, oh, Matt did one of those last week. Spot on. we'll use Matt because he knows exactly what he's doing. And again, that person will be a lot more productive, a lot more efficient in what they do because they've done it. You know, that's one of the first questions. Have you done this before? If they say, no, I've never been involved in this type of case before, you think, right, well, do you know somebody who has? Because I really want somebody who's actually got some experience in this.
Yeah, and which actually I think, now thinking it's bringing back memories, but that kind of is what makes it attractive using a firm that has, it's not just a one-man band.
Yeah.
Because there is basically a, you know, you're tying into hundreds of years of combined experience, and there's pretty much always someone that can do something.
Exactly.
I actually wanted to ask you, and maybe you need to just explain this for me in layman terms, yeah. But you said make sure you've got someone that has experience in adjudication. Wouldn't all lawyers have, maybe explain to me what adjudication is and why some firms wouldn't have experience, because I would have thought everyone does if you
adjudication is just business. It's just for the construction industry, so it only applies to construction contracts where those contracts are involved in construction operations. So it's the majority of construction projects will amount to construction operations. Give you oil and gas isn't. So you know, when government introduced it, there was some lobbying and certain sectors managed to fall outside the scope of the Housing Grants Act. So adjudication was brought in because in the 90s, there's a thing called the Latham Report where cash flow was stifling the industry. You know, it was causing real problems. So they introduced adjudication as a quick fix. And so the first adjudications were around 98, 99, just for a turn of the millennium. And it's been working ever since, and it's rough justice, and it's 35 days. So it doesn't matter the value or the nature of the dispute. It's 35 days, start to finish. It can be extended by up to 14 days with agreement of the referring party. So the referring party, the party who wants to bring the dispute, and it can only be one dispute at any one time, but that one dispute could be, what's our final account worth? Which could encompass lots of matters, couldn't it? The referring party has the luxury of spending as long as it likes preparing for an adjudication. The responding party, the defending party, will have between 7 and 14 days to reply. So it could be, and in that time, it could be a delay-related dispute. They might have to go to get a delay expert to produce a report. You can imagine the intensity of that process within such a short time frame. The beauty of it is you get a quick decision. It's really cost effective. And that decision is interim binding. So the parties, the court generally upholds the decision. So unless the tribunal, unless the person who is the adjudicator, which could be an architect, there's a panel, the RICS, the RIBA, they have panels of people who are experts. They will decide the dispute, so they're not legally qualified necessarily, and the courts will say we're going to uphold those decisions. Even if they got it wrong, the court will still uphold it, unless there's been some sort of breach of natural justice, in which case the courts will look at it, but to give it teeth, the courts uphold it.
So you were saying just to make sure if you are appointing a firm that they have experience actually going through that process.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
One of the things which you actually said, which now kind of makes more sense now you've explained it to me in those terms, when we were talking about, you know, outcomes for this recording, was you sort of said, I'd like to communicate about not to be afraid of adjudication. Can you just expand on that a little bit about what maybe makes people afraid of it when they hear the word and stuff, and again, what, why you, from your perspective, it's not a bad thing necessarily. I mean, you've mentioned about the speed, but there are other aspects to it.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, and you said yourself, I think something about, you know, people having, doing deals in the bar, you know, having a pint, generally in the industry, people get on, don't they? And there's a lot of repeat business, and, you know, the reason why people get new work is because they've been recommended. So nobody really wants to fall out or get into the dispute. But unfortunately, it happens. Things don't quite go to plan. So in those situations, I'm providing other avenues of being exhausted. So commercial discussions. I mean, my advice would always be have those commercial discussions. Try and resolve the dispute. If it can't be resolved because individuals are very much, strong-willed, then take it away from those individuals and move it to somebody else who can, deal with the issue. But if it can't be resolved and it has to go to adjudication, then I think because it's such a quick process, you can fix the costs. There's no liability for the opponent's costs. So if you lose, your exposure is the adjudicator's fee. So, and the lawyer who you instructed would give you an idea as to what sort of level of fee that might be. So you can then, you can undertake a sort of cost risk analysis saying, well, I'm looking at recovering 100 grand and I know the adjudicator's fee, if I lose, could be 15. I know my own lawyer's fees, because they told me, is going to be fixed at 20. Then my potential exposure is 35 against a potential recovery of 100. Is that a good set of betting scenarios, as in... Because the thing you have to bear in mind is adjudication is rough justice. So because of the time frame, not every stone will be unturned. So potentially it can leave unhappy customers because the person who's having to decide has not got all information, or he's not been able to absorb all information, and you're stuck with that decision. So...
I think the time aside is a massive factor, because... I think it's still the case that since COVID, like the length of time it takes to get kind of the courts to respond to things, and I've seen it for myself, the distraction that causes in the business, and you're losing money elsewhere because you're trying to deal with things, and actually to have something where you can get it sorted within, or at least get a decision, because often it's often just about just the decision. Okay, what are we doing, and how are we going to change our business or adjust to carry on going forward?
Is a
big thing. Thank you so much for this conversation, Alan. It was really, really insightful. So I learned a lot today, but also I think you've reminded me about kind of the smaller things as well that we sometimes. Overplay, like just kind of communication, having good documentation, and how some of that proactive stuff can actually limit the involvement of people like yourselves, but actually make your job easier if you are going to get involved. So I'd love to do at some point maybe another episode more about claiming money back as well, because I think that's a whole nother topic that we could explore with you. But thanks a lot for your time, Alan.
No, I'm delighted, JP. Thanks for having me.